1674. 2. A crow can recall every route it has ever taken, and Caden had been this way before. Crows are messengers, spies, guides, companions, harbingers of luck, deliverers of trinkets and treasures, tireless in all ways, more loyal than any other man or beast. This one had been connected to his mistress from the time she was a baby in her basket of reeds, which was why he knew her thoughts and wishes and was aware of the destination she wanted most. A familiar is such a creature, an animal or bird that sees inside to the very soul of its human companion and knows what others might not, what fears there might be, and what joys, for it shares the emotions of its human partner. They were on their way west, to the house where Caden had found the silver hairpin, which he'd daringly plucked from its owner's long red hair, though she'd cursed him and thrown stones into the air aimed at him, managing only to graze him. He'd avoided her when she'd come to Devotion Field, bringing her troubles with her, but now he was headed directly toward her. He knew she was a complicated woman, and crows do not judge harshly unless they have good reason to do so. They had come to the Thames estuary, where the footing was as much water as it was land, a river of grass. Once or twice Maria felt herself pushed down into the rich mud that had claimed so many souls who had dared and failed to cross here. But she could not sink. It was not in her nature to do so, and for that she was grateful. Her dress was soon enough soaked, but no earthly difficulties troubled her. She had seen something no girl her age should see, the murder of someone she loved. The violence she'd viewed had changed and embittered her. If she had been a child before, she was no longer. Her eyes were darker, an ocean gray. Her mouth was set in a fierce, unyielding line. She was bitter, and in some ways stronger than before. A stormy, cloud-clotted sky didn't cause her to take shelter to find rest. Rain didn't stop her. She was on a path she had decided upon as she watched Hannah tied to her door. With each step, Maria was more resolved. She raged at a world that would allow such injustice to occur. How could the rural, verdant beauty all around her be the domain of such cruelty, a place in which the larks chattered despite the dangers they faced, unable to keep silent as they sang the praises of the sky? Maria knew now that she was not like those around her. Why that should be, she now wished to understand. All she knew was what Hannah had taught her. Life was worth living, no matter what fate might bring. That was why Maria went forward. She had decided to find her mother. Rebecca had returned to the manor house at the edge of a vast parkland that had once belonged to a king, unaware of her husband's attack on Hannah. She assumed she would find him at home. She intended to act as if nothing was wrong, hopeful that Hannah's spell had done the trick, making him fall out of love with her, so he was willing to let her go. But her husband wasn't at home, and frankly she was grateful not to have to face him. A king's fortunes could fail, and so had her husband's. Thomas Lachlan had royal blood, diluted by hatred and drink. Theirs was a case of love gone wrong. Such things happened even to the wisest of women. Rebecca had been young when she met her husband-to-be, at an age when she saw only what the outside of a man revealed. She was inexperienced enough to assume what they had was love, because she wanted him, and want can be 100 times stronger than need, and 1,000 times stronger than common sense. She used the 10th love potion, an enchantment only fit for those so desperate they did not fear the consequences, and there were always consequences. The payment for this potion was dear and had, in the past, cost the user her well-being. It was the one that could turn a person inside out and destroy one or both parties. Desire, if handled incorrectly, could become a curse. It had been easy enough for her to bewitch him, but what was sent into the world came back threefold, so strong it was tainted. She had wanted him to burn with love for her, and burn he did, three times as much as anyone should, with a vicious passion that did more damage than Rebecca would have imagined possible. In time, she had turned to another man, her one true love, and she'd kept that love a secret. This was the reason she had hid her pregnancy, concealed beneath shifts and cloaks, and why she had gone into the woods by herself to give birth, already having decided she must give the child away before Thomas took the baby from her. Perhaps Rebecca was too selfish to be a good mother. All the same, she wanted to ensure that Maria would never have a taste of the brand of love she herself had known, in which a woman was all but owned and had no choice as to her own fate, with or without the use of magic. She used blue silk thread to bring good luck when she initialed her own garments, and she did the same on the woolen blanket for her baby girl. Each day she had wondered what had become of the child, and if she had inherited the skills women in the family were known for. She had traveled to see who Maria had become, even though it meant risking the wrath of a man she feared. On the evening when Caden brought Maria to the manor house, Rebecca was celebrating being alone. She had loosened her hair and had begun to drink the rum imported from the West Indies that her husband kept under lock and key, for she could open the catch with a flick of her wrist and a hairpin. Thomas Lachlan's brothers were currently ailing after breathing in the fumes of the poison garden, and Thomas himself was unable to move or speak. In such a state, his family worried that he might lose his life. He had been brought to his family's home, north and farther from the sea, so that his sisters could care for him. The Lachlans had no cause to trust Rebecca, who had already planted the apple seeds from the amulet Hannah had crafted, so that in time there would be an orchard, where the variety of apple called Everlasting brought true love to anyone who ate the fruit grown in this valley. Rebecca was grateful to be alone in the huge, drafty house, and even more grateful to be rid of her oppressor, for magic can only do so much when an initial spell has already been set. As the night fell, however, she felt a nest of nerves coiling around her heart. That evening at dinner, a spoon had fallen, a sign that meant company was coming, something Rebecca most assuredly didn't want. She had been a selfish girl, but she was a cunning woman, and she knew that everything came in threes, including death. She took a bowl and filled it with water and ink, and there she saw Hannah nailed to her door, and Thomas in his bed suffering from poison. Rebecca feared that she herself might be the third one to be afflicted. She was waiting for death to come through the door. Perhaps her husband's sisters would send their own husbands and sons to come here and fill Rebecca's boots with stones before wrapping her in chains and throwing her into the river, where the weeds grew tall as a man and the rushing current led to the sea. The knock on the door was light, however not death's hand, but the tapping of a bird's beak. It was the crow, the robber who had been here many times before. Women who are unlucky in love must throw their silver out the front door if they want to improve their fortunes, and Rebecca had often done so. There was a field of silver, tarnished from the witch's touch, and the meadow appeared glazed with light when the moon rose. It was a perfect treasure trove for a curious crow. "Leave here," Rebecca demanded, for she recognized the creature that had been cheeky enough to take the comb from her hair. If she wasn't mistaken, he still had a scar on his head from one of the rocks she'd thrown to chase him off. Caden knew what this woman was capable of, and he flew away, his wings obscuring the rising moon. Rebecca stepped over the threshold, one hand over her eye, so that she could see him well enough to spell him and be rid of him once and for all. But then she spied Maria, and all else fell away. There was the baby she'd left in Devotion Field, now a dark fury of a girl in sopping clothes, her black hair in knots. Rebecca went to meet her daughter halfway. The grass was damp, and she left footprints behind, each one turning as dark as some of the choices she had made. In truth, she was anxious, for the girl was an unusual creature. Even Rebecca, who usually cared only about her own affairs, could see that. Talent is something you're born with. It's a gift and a curse, and it's often cause for jealousy from those who are without it. Although in this case, Maria's talents brought Rebecca a good deal of pride. She was a mother, after all. She might not look like one or act like one, yet she had a mother's heart. Great power was something to be celebrated. "Why did you give me away?" Maria called out with more emotion than she wished to reveal, for this was the question she'd been carrying inside her ever since she'd come to learn that Hannah was not her mother. "For your own safety." An excuse was an excuse, but this one was true. "To protect me from my father?" Maria was too clever to accept an easy answer. There was no reason for Rebecca to lie anymore. And even if she had, Maria would have known. It was clear the girl had the sight. What was to come was in the corner of Maria's eye, so that she spied both the present and the future. A death, a blessing, a love affair. She could see it all, and the world knew it and responded to her. White moths were collecting in the grass all around her. Doves gathered in the branches of one of the oldest elm trees in the county. Robbers had been hanged from its branches. The tree had turned blood red wherever a rope had been tied, and the ground beneath it was red as well. No grass grew here. The Lachlan family had a legacy of greed and cruelty, and even the trees knew their history. "My husband was not your father," Rebecca admitted in a soft voice. "But surely I had one." Maria's face was pinched. She felt twisted inside. Hannah Owens had been her family, and now she felt alone in the world. "Or perhaps you no longer remember who he was, as you failed to remember that your husband would punish whoever might help you. Your men came to kill the woman who raised me." Maria met her mother's gaze, unafraid. She blamed Rebecca for Hannah's death, and it was in her nature to speak her mind. She could already tell her mother might be more learned when it came to magic. But of the two, Maria was stronger. "I did not mean for that to happen," Rebecca vowed. "She was a good woman. That was why I left you with her. I never thought my husband would be able to follow my trail." Rebecca's red hair nearly reached to her waist. She was vain, and she always had been, but her expression showed heartfelt remorse. "I laid out cayenne, pepper, and lavender to confuse his dogs. I thought he'd prefer his drink to me, and that he'd be too filled with rum to find where I'd been. That was my mistake. I underestimated the power of the tenth. I know I can't undo what has been done, but even if I am at fault, I wish you would stay with me. If you ever have a child and lose her, a tragedy I wouldn't wish on any living soul, then perhaps you will forgive me." Maria scrutinized the house. 3 stories of pale stone with a cobbled courtyard, the home of the Lachlans for over 200 years. She looked at her mother, who had given birth by herself in a snowy field despite her fine manor house, and who had initialed Maria's blanket with blue silk thread spun halfway across the world by glowing worms that turned into moths with bright wings. Perhaps it was meant to be. Maria would take a chamber on the second floor, the largest one, with a lock on the door so she could have her privacy, for magic was a private affair, even between mother and daughter. And magic was all she cared about now. Although Rebecca could neither read nor write, when it came to matters of love, she was an expert. Her grimoire was filled with runic marks, the ancient alphabet of alchemy. She used these symbols to denote which herbs to use and which to avoid, which spells were best to recite in the waning or waxing of the moon, to bring forth the power of the earth and sky, incantations which were dangerous in a novice's hands. She taught Maria the 8 lesser love charms and the 9th potion, which was so potent one must wear gloves during its preparation. The 10th potion was the one she herself had used, and she did not recommend the use of that enchantment. If she knew Maria had copied it into her own grimoire at the very back of her book, she did not say. She only told her daughter to be vigilant. There were sinister aspects of magic, and what you brought into this world was your responsibility to deal with forevermore. Rebecca herself was drawn toward the dark, what some people called left-handed magic, and she certainly didn't care about any man's wrath, even after her years with her husband, who had known enough about her skills to set out a circle of salt around her and tie her to an iron chair before he beat her, for salt and iron deplete a witch's talents. Of course he would want to change her once he knew what she was. That was the way their love first unraveled. Rebecca knew how to blind a man and how to make him see again. What herbs would help to bring on a pregnancy, as well as those that would end that condition. Rebecca was as acquainted with the many forms of magic as she was with the corners and walls of her own bedchamber. She was a seeker of revenge, fearless since her first day on earth. She, too, had grown up as a motherless child, and because of this, Rebecca had learned to survive by her wits early on. Her own mother was a witch who had disappeared after her daughter's birth. Rebecca was an outcast from the start, for her father did not wish to have her in his household. It was no mistake that Rebecca had left her daughter in Devotion Field, rather than with a nurse, as she had experienced the terrors of such a childhood. For what was perceived as a bit of magic, a white deer that came to her unafraid, the sight of the red crescent mark on her leg, she'd been slapped and beaten by her nurse, then locked in a dark room until she learned to keep her talents to herself. The nurse had granted Rebecca one meal a day, unless she stole from the pantry, which she always did. She thanked that horrible woman now. The nurse had taught her how to survive, and Rebecca made her way on her beauty and her talents to the home of the Lachlans, but she had wanted a real home for her daughter. She'd heard of Hannah Owens and her remedies and had chosen Hannah to raise her child with kindness and a gift for the nameless art. Now, after all these years, she had the chance to mentor the girl herself. Rebecca felt that she was Maria's proper teacher, with access to private knowledge known only to the women in their family. They'd come from a long line of women whose blood burned black in the snow, who could cure or wound with words and herbs, who spoke to birds and bees, who changed the weather and were either feared or respected by their neighbors. Studying under her mother's tutelage, Maria wrote down lists of herbs and useful plants in her grimoire, along with remedies for sorrow, illness, childbirth ailments, jealousy, headache, rashes, desire. There were other spells, not medicinal treatments, but spiritual, ancient enchantments that began with the Hebrew word abracadabra, I create as I speak, taken from the even earlier Aramaic chant, abracadabra, it will be created in my words. Some spells were too dangerous to use, unless there was no choice, for they could wound the practitioner as well as the object of their conjuring. Spells for revenge or survival, in which the spellmaker's own blood was used as ink to ensure that only she could read the words. Sympathetic magic, using poppets and lifelike figures, and when revenge was involved, pins and hooks. Poisons that were tasteless and odorless, but stung like a wasp before they could be noticed. Black magic, red magic, blood magic, love magic. Rebecca divided both the world that she walked through and the world that was unseen into these categories. Maria kept her book under the floorboards beside her bed. No women came here asking for Rebecca's help, even if they might have wished for it. They were all too frightened of her. She did not mind if a subject had to take ill or die in order for her to get her way. A pin in a poppet, a vial of blood, a bird bled to death on the hearth. All of it was in her book, brought to bear when deemed useful. There was a distance between Maria and her mother, for they were still strangers to each other, and they saw their place in the world quite differently. Maria had grown up learning to help those in need, while Rebecca thought only to help herself. Still, Maria was interested in all Rebecca had to teach her. They were blood relations, after all, and one often knew what the other was thinking before the words were spoken aloud. Each also had the ability to keep secrets by throwing up a screen that blocked her most private thoughts. Shared blood didn't account for everything. They were different as night from day. Maria knew in her heart that if she'd been the one in that snowy field, she would have never left her child on her own. For Love Gone Wrong. Vervain eases the pain of unrequited love. A cobweb on a door means your beloved has been untrue. To bring about passion, aniseed, burdock root, myrtle leaves. Amulets for luck are made of blue beads, dove feathers, mistletoe, wishbones. All spells increase with the waxing moon, decrease with the waning moon. Place 2 eggs under the bed to cleanse the atmosphere. Destroy afterward. Do not eat, or you will swallow bad fortune. A mirror beside you reflects back the evil eye. For protection against love, black cloth, red thread, clove, blackthorn. In the year 1675, when Maria turned 11, there was another epidemic of smallpox. Some towns and villages were emptied of all their inhabitants, and the doors to houses swung open, and robbers ruled the roads. It was a sorrowful and ruthless time. All the same, Rebecca often disappeared at night. It seemed she had a destination she would not or could not refuse when it called to her. She tossed a cape over her shining hair, gazed at herself in the painted black mirror that revealed the future, then ignored her fate and did as she pleased. She was headstrong and had always been so, especially in matters of love, as had been true for her own mother. The women in their family had the talent of the nameless art, but Rebecca admitted they all had difficulties with love. They were prone to ignore the rules and warnings inside their own hearts and heads. Love could ruin your life or set you free. It could happen by chance or be a well-planned decision. When Rebecca returned in the mornings after her nights out, there were brambles in her clothes and her hair was unbraided. She had marks on her throat and shoulders as if she'd been bitten by some animal, and she was so overheated she had no need of a cloak. Even at Maria's young age, she knew there was only one reason for her mother to vanish and to spend all of the next day asleep, with the door to her room bolted shut. Night after night she disappeared, wearing her finest clothes, black crinolines, red dresses, and red boots. One dew-drenched morning, when the sun had not yet risen, Rebecca returned to find Maria waiting for her in the silver pasture, which was littered with spoons and candlesticks and platters, all tossed out the door to bring her luck. Caden had presented Maria with 3 strands of black hair, and when she held them in her hand, she knew her mother's secret. Rebecca stopped where she stood when she realized Maria was there to greet her in the foggy morning. She had been caught red-handed, as if she were the wayward girl and Maria the strict caretaker. Her boots were slick with mud, and she had a fresh bite mark on her throat, as if someone had mistaken her delicate flesh for an apple. She raised her chin, defiant. She had been a willful girl, and that trait didn't often disappear. "Do you want to ask me a question?" she asked her daughter. The girl was growing up, and quickly. It was already possible to see the woman she would soon be, dark and far too curious for her own good. She came to judgments easily, and held a grudge, and was fiercely loyal. She'd had her first blood, therefore some might call her a woman already. Certainly she had more skill than Rebecca would have imagined possible. Maria was a weather witch and could stop rain by standing in a downpour with her arms uplifted. She could melt the drifts of snow that she walked upon. Cures for fevers, love madness, insomnia, bad luck. all were within her reach. Neighbors from the nearby farms came to see her, out of her mother's line of sight, waiting anxiously beside the empty barn where Maria dried herbs. Rebecca believed magic should never be shared or bought. For her, it was a bloodline talent meant for family members alone. But Maria had learned otherwise from Hannah. What gifts you had, you are meant to share. What you set out into the world came back to you threefold. If a child was ill, if an old woman was losing her sight, if a family knew suffering, she was willing to do what she could on their behalf. She charged nothing, but accepted whatever they gave. A silver spoon, a currant cake, a copper coin. Now, as her mother approached after being gone all night, Maria held up the strands of hair the crow had brought her earlier that morning. They were the exact same color as her own hair, black as midnight, but coarser. She knew exactly who they belonged to. The man who'd been responsible for her life. She could sense who he was. A man who lived in shadow, who did as he pleased, who could convince people he was one thing when he was someone else entirely. "I thought I had no father," Maria said. "No official father." "But a father all the same. One you have come from right now." When she gave Rebecca the dark strands of hair, her mother held them with a rare tenderness and stored them in a locket she wore around her throat. A farm boy came riding by, tentative and nervous as he neared the house where people in the village said there lived not one witch, but two. One might curse you, one might cure you, but two had the power to do as they pleased, and there'd be no defense against them. In this world, witches were best to be avoided at all costs. Still, the boy did as his master had instructed. His horse was old and nearly lame, but the boy rode him as quickly as he could. No messenger wanted to be caught and questioned by Rebecca Lachland. "That boy's horse has a tail as black as your hair," Rebecca said as she watched the worried rider. "Perhaps the old stallion is your father, and you're only half human." Maria had her hand on her hips. She did not like to be taken for a fool, even by her own mother. "If there's one thing I know for certain, it's that the non-human half was inherited from you." Mother and daughter were more than ready to quarrel as they faced each other in the field. But they had begun to pay closer attention to the boy, who leapt from the horse to nail a piece of parchment to the door, then jumped back onto his old steed to race out of sight, before Maria and Rebecca reached the house. Out of breath, Rebecca tore the paper from the door and handed it to Maria to read. "Your husband's family claims this house and will come for it and all of your belongings tomorrow," Maria told her mother. "They are legally entitled to everything, as your husband is ailing and in their care." A single woman might own property, but a wife was entitled to nothing, and the proclamation came as no surprise. The Lachlan house had been a prison, and Rebecca was glad to have good reason to leave it. She had another life to live elsewhere. They went to pack up all that mattered to them, which, as it turned out, wasn't much. Maria took a change of clothes and her grimoire, along with pen and ink, the black mirror of divination, and the bell from Hannah's door. Rebecca gathered some jewelry, along with a pistol that had been a favorite of her husband's, and the rest of the blackened silverware. If they stayed here, they would likely be sent to Bridewell Prison, where as paupers and women alone, they would be set to work and kept confined, perhaps for the rest of their lives. The wisest move was to flee as far from Essex County as possible. It was always best to step into the future while it was still waiting for you. In fact, there was a man who was Rebecca's past, present, and future. For him, Rebecca had planted a night garden that bloomed after dark. Angel's trumpet, moonflower, night jasmine, evening primrose, all waited for the moon to rise. Both Maria and Rebecca wore skirts that were ankle length, best to wear when riding, and neither bothered with petticoats that would only be dragged in the mud. Before they walked outside, Rebecca placed the second hairpin in Maria's hair. You might as well let him see you at your best. How do you know he's coming here? We have made a decision to leave here. The Lachlans will come for this place, and we can't be here when they do. As for your father, he's always been waiting for me. Maria took him to be her father the instant she saw him approach. His horse was black, as was his hair, and he wore a long overcoat and black velvet breeches that had once been elegant, but now were threadbare. It was clear that witches didn't frighten him. He shouted out for Rebecca, a grin on his face, and in return she called him Robbie, such a sweet name in her mouth she sounded like a girl again, the one she'd been on the day she'd first met him, when he'd been a member in a company of players, often taking the part of the hero, and she had been rapt all the while she watched him, certain that he was the one for her. He'd turned to crime during the plague years, when theaters were shut down due to illness and Puritan beliefs. Many of Shakespeare's plays hadn't been revived until recently, and then in altered form. Still, there were rogue companies of players, and some would still hire Robbie despite his history and his bad reputation in the theaters of London, where he had stolen from some of his contemporaries, charming them as he did so. As time went on, he became more of a thief than a player, and he couldn't return to his true calling. All the same, he thought of himself not as a robber, really, but rather as a man portraying a robber, and in this role he had excelled. Horses were his specialty, and the hearts of women, and other men's savings. When he noticed Maria, he gazed at her, curious, but asked no questions, merely nodded a greeting. She was such a solemn creature, with her black hair parted down the middle and her pretty, somber mouth in the shape of a black rose. He would not know how to describe her, so he merely shook his head. He was quite marvelous at speaking other people's words, but otherwise could not express himself. Some men are tongue-tied in that way. They need a prompt that allows them to release their emotions, unless they are in bed with a woman they love, and then they reveal themselves in a thousand ways. Maria gazed at her parents as they embraced. She herself would want more. A man who talked, who could speak for hours and still be worth listening to, as he told stories of his own making. A man who listened to what you had to say. Most times this particular man, called Robbie for as long as he could remember, tried not to think about all that he'd done in order to survive in the world. Robbie had brought with him a horse for Maria to ride, recently appropriated from a local farmer, and he took Rebecca onto his own. At last he had the love of his life beside him, and for him this was enough. Thieves have hearts and souls, and his heart was pounding. Before they left, he took a flint, and with a spark he lit some hay wrapped around an arrow. He shot the lit arrow into the door of the house, then shot six others similarly made through the windows. He'd done this very same thing in a play once, one about the son of a king who yearned for vengeance, but then the flaming arrows had been aimed into a bucket of sand off stage. Now he clearly took pleasure in what was a very real act. When he smiled, his face changed. He was as handsome as a boy again, and Maria could see why her mother loved him so. "There's my gift to you," he told Rebecca as the flames went up. Even though the grand stone house would be standing when the Lord's family came to make their claim, everything inside would be burned to ash. That was vengeance, pure and simple, for all the years her husband had stolen from them. They went through the estuary, riding south. At times the horses were chest deep in water. It was a glorious golden day. Riding behind her parents, Maria could hear a spray of her mother's laughter, a beautiful musical sound. There seemed a sea change in Rebecca now that Robbie had come for her. She was not a witch, merely a woman in love. Clearly she allowed her raw emotions to lead her astray. Maria thought of all the things she should have asked during the time she'd spent with her mother. She'd gathered knowledge about enchantments and remedies, but no knowledge about their own history. How they had come to be the way they were, What trick of nature were they? Why did their blood burn black? Why should they avoid water at all costs if they could not sink? For some, witchery was a choice, but not for them. It was in their very nature, and they must do their best with it. But how did a woman survive when she would surely be judged again and again? Now it was too late to ask. The future was upon them, and Maria could see it would split in two, their fates diverging as they went their separate ways. Every once in a while, the man who was Maria's father would turn to gaze over his shoulder at her, as if he continued to be surprised that she existed. There was clearly no room for her. The love between her mother and father was exclusive and couldn't contain anyone else. Some love is like that. It only has room enough to fit two people who can only see one another and include no one else. The love between them was the reason her mother could leave her in the snowy field, to hide Maria's cap of black hair so that no one would suspect who the baby's father might be. He'd never been apprehended as a robber, but he wouldn't have escaped Thomas Lachlan's murderous rage had Lachlan ever found out the truth and discovered his wife had a lover. As good an actor as he might be, Maria's father would never have been mistaken for an innocent man. They rode for a very long time, and when at last they came to the sea, Maria was both terrified and thrilled. The water stretched out before them, a wild blue field of waves. The sound was deafening, the possibilities enormous. There was another unknown world beyond their own, and frankly, Maria was done with England, and had been since the fire in Devotion Field. She was glad that Caden was on her shoulder, her one true friend, for the world seemed very big and she felt young and small. They stopped at an inn to take some food. Robbie went inside while Rebecca waited hidden in a yew hedge so she would not be recognized should her husband's family come searching after they found the manor house burned from the inside out. Robbie brought out some meat and bread and cheese. Maria fed the crow but took nothing for herself. "Do you wish to starve?" the man who was her father asked. He said it more out of interest than concern. His eyes were pitch black, and he had a wide mouth and high cheekbones, as she did. He was so handsome that women in London often followed him down the street. Some fainted at the sight of him, as if he were the hero in the theatricals they'd seen come to life. A smile played at his lips as he spoke to Maria, for her presence continued to puzzle and amuse him. She was a great beauty, and in his experience that would bring her both good fortune and grief. In many ways, Robbie was a simple man, and he stood in judgment of no one. He knew what Rebecca was and did not fault her for it. A witch was a funny thing, particularly when you loved her. If not for Rebecca, he would not be in the strange circumstance of trying to rescue a black-haired girl who stared at him with cold eyes when they should have already left the country. He wished he could write a drama that would tell the story of the night when he first saw Rebecca and came under her spell. She was already married, not that it mattered to either one of them, for their love for each other consumed everything in their way. That much was clear to Maria. "Tell me, girl," he said to this strange daughter of his, "what is it you want in this world?" "I wish to have a life that I can claim for my own, without paying for the crimes of my mother and father," Maria told him. "Where do I go to do that?" When she squinted, the present was transparent, and she could view a future where Caden flew above her in a different world, a place where every plant was one she had never seen before, a land in which there were trees with thorns and trees bent over in the wind, trees with blood-red leaves and those with branches as white as snow. They were not far from a harbor, and gulls wheeled across the sky. The city of London was nearby, and smoke rose from the city's chimneys in great black clouds. A city such as this was a wondrous and terrible thing where anything could happen. It was the place where one could find the end of her days or the beginning of her life. And yet Maria knew that this city was not the place where she would find her future. Rebecca had come to stand beside her man. "That's why we're here," Rebecca told their daughter. "So that you will have a life of your own. It's your future we're thinking of. We're sending you away." "I can't say I'm surprised," Maria said with dark bitterness. What would they want with her when they were so involved with one another? Her parents exchanged a look. She was difficult indeed. Still, she was theirs, and they meant to see she was safely away from Thomas Lachlan's family, who might wish her ill. There was a far-off place called Curaçao, a Dutch island where she might have a future that was very different from the solitary life in the fens that Hannah Owens had known. She could remain in a place where a woman alone had no rights to her own life, or she could agree to her parents' plan and travel half a world away where anything might be possible. "Fine," Maria said, grabbing for a crust of bread. The truth was she was starving. She'd met her father and known her mother and had been lucky enough to have been found by Hannah Owens. Now she was ready for a life of her own. "I'll go where you send me, but the crow comes along." They went on to Southampton, and in a shop near the docks, Rebecca bought her daughter parting gifts. A heavy woolen cape and a pair of boots for her journey. Maria slipped off her ragged shoes made of worn leather lined with wool. She was delighted with her gifts. The cloak was soft and lovely, and the boots were a pure wonder, red leather, made in Spain. Every witch should own a pair, whether she worked in a field or walked through the halls of a manor house. Rebecca was happy that she had pleased her daughter with her purchases. "I know you better than you thought I might," she said cheerfully. "We're of the same blood, and we favor the same things." In her way, Rebecca loved her child dearly. But what you give up, you can learn to live without, even if it causes you heartbreak at the start. Whether you are mortal or not, you go on, even if sorrow nags at you. Rebecca did not bequeath her grimoire to her daughter, but then Maria had not expected her to do so, for it was still in use, and Maria had written down all of her mother's knowledge in her own book. Instead, Rebecca gave her a leather bag which included several packets of useful herbs, beeswax candles, and a spool of blue silk thread, all for the creation of amulets and potions. "Never be without thread," she told the girl. "What is broken can also be mended. Remember that in your dark days, as I have." There was also a bag of oranges from Spain bought at a market, and worth their high price. "This will keep you well and healthy on board a ship. Take my advice and stay away from men for as long as you can. Love is trouble, and trouble is love." A fine bit of guidance from a woman who'd so thoughtlessly loved the wrong man not once, but twice. Even here, along the docks, where life swirled all around them, she couldn't take her gaze away from Robbie. Likely it was true that the flaws you saw in other women you didn't notice in yourself. Love everlasting, love wished for desperately, love that walks in through the door, love that is a mistake, love that is yours alone. Robbie had fashioned a bargain with the captain of a ship from Amsterdam that, in his opinion, would favor everyone, including himself. Now that the deal had been struck, he was waiting with the horses more than ready to go. He let out a low whistle and bowed, the most handsome man in three counties. Rebecca grinned and waved, as if her heart were in her hand. Anyone with even a bit of the sight could tell there would surely be trouble ahead. "Is this what love is?" Maria asked her mother, who was gazing at Robbie on the pier. "Oh, yes," Rebecca said. "I'd die for it." In fact, she would. When Robbie was caught by the sheriff for crimes he had committed, she would be hanged alongside him, not for witchery, of which she would have likely been found guilty, but as an accomplice to horse theft, a crime with which her man was well acquainted. When there was gossip about Rebecca, she had herbs with her and wore talismans on her wrists and at her throat. The jailers clasped iron shoes on her feet, and as witches are helpless in the grip of that metal, she could not work her magic. She could only weep tears that scalded the ground beneath them. Robbie would give a speech that many in the crowd, especially the women, would remember for years to come. He'd speak of a love that would never end, about the world they shared and the heaven they would share as well. He would quote from The Tempest, a revival of which he'd had the honor to be a part of. Though his words to Rebecca were so heartfelt, everyone thought they were his own. "Hear my soul speak. The very instant that I saw you, did my heart fly to your service." The crowd would listen appreciatively, for they were fine words indeed, and many of the women would applaud. But they would hang him all the same. Rebecca could see bits and pieces of the event to come when she looked into a pool of water in the gutter. Still, that awful occurrence would not be for months, and the time they had together was precious, and part of a bargain Rebecca was willing to make. "Love is not always under our control," she told her daughter. "It will never be that for me." Maria was already wearing the red boots, and although she adored the gift, she would avoid her mother's path at all costs. She vowed she would never let love rule her life. Mother and daughter said their goodbyes on the dock, embracing one another, their true feelings surfacing. Despite all the time they had been apart, they had similar hearts, surprisingly easy to break. But they were strong when it mattered, and it mattered now, for they both understood that they would not meet again. The world was so much larger than Maria would have ever imagined, and all that lived in the sea seemed enormous as well. The creatures that swam alongside the ship, spouting foul-smelling water, and slithering dark things that clung to the hull, fish whose mouths were filled with teeth, scaly sea snakes and blue crabs pulled up in nets overflowing with dark purple seaweed. At night, the stars tore through the black sky, and when it rained, the world itself seemed upside down, with water above and below. Strong men cried and called for their mothers during the worst of these storms, and fish leapt onto the deck to escape the roiling waves, but Caden clattered into Maria's ear that they merely needed to stay alive, nothing more. Take a breath, hold tight, and soon enough the sky would reappear, blue as glass, and the men would return to work, not remembering how they wept for their mother's arms. These same sailors did not soon forget that Maria could announce a storm before it appeared on the horizon, any more than they would forego her remedies, for she was soon enough known to be a healer, and many of the men had learned to come to her when they were ill. She might have been in danger from their rough ways, for even at her young age she was a woman in most of their eyes. But no one dared to harm her or search her out in a dark corner. She knew more than most women twice her age. They could see it in her eyes, their own fates reflecting back to them. Maria knew how to use spirits of turpentine to prevent lockjaw, salt and molasses for a salve used on deep cuts that might otherwise poison a man's blood, black or green tea steeped with boiling milk and nutmeg for dysentery. If a man among them had hurt Maria, he would only be damaging his own chances at completing the long journey whole and well. She was valued, and although none would admit it aloud, all the crew felt fortunate to have her aboard. For sea travel. Hyssop tea will rid a man of worms. Basil will preserve fish. Borage can heal abscesses. Ginger and vinegar for sores. Mint for toothache. If the cat on board sleeps in a coil, the weather will be bad. If the sun rises red, there will be rain. Do not take salt from another person's hand at the table, or you will both have bad luck. If salt spills, throw a pinch over your left shoulder. blue thread sewn onto every piece of clothing for protection. Hannah had taught Maria how to keep weevils out of the biscuits, and for this the cook and all the passengers were extremely thankful. Rats could be done away with by the use of monk's hood, caraway was good for spider bites, peony root guarded against storms, nightmares, and lunacy, for there were those who were made mad by the endless rush of the sea. Because of those she had cured, Maria was thought to be a saint by some, although there were others who were certain she was a witch, for sailors were a superstitious lot, and their traditions included attempts at seafaring magic. A silver coin was always placed beneath the mast, a page of paper was never to be torn in two on board, a brand was used to mark wooden masts to drive out evil spirits and to keep the vessel safe in storms. Caden, who might have been deemed unlucky or perhaps seen as a harbinger of death and destruction, was welcomed when Maria insisted he was a black albatross. Although none of the sailors had ever heard of such a creature before, they all knew there were marvelous new things to be found in the world every day, and since an albatross brings luck to sailors, no one dared to challenge Maria. The captain, a Dutchman named Dries Hessel, who always wore a knee-length coat treated with tar and animal grease for waterproofing, did little that did not bring a profit. That was why he'd allowed the girl on board. He'd arranged to sell her for 60 shillings once they reached Curaçao, a good bargain, considering he'd paid Maria's father only 40 for her. A player in the theater survived as he must, and the captain of a ship assumed it was also his right to do the same, even when the object he sold was a person. Maria would be an indentured servant for a period of 5 years, and whoever bought her would own her outright during this time, then be legally responsible for freeing her on the appointed date that ended her servitude. That the girl had used her blue thread to sew up a wound Hessel suffered when a windstorm drove a splinter of the mast through his flesh had done nothing to change his mind regarding her fate. Nothing was free in this world, not a breath, not a life, not a journey. Many on board were Portuguese refugees who had paid whatever price necessary for their passage, as they pursued an escape from persecution for their faith. Jews were not allowed in Spain or Portugal or in England or France, and so they had set off for the New World, practicing their religion in secret, until the time came when they at last found a place that offered a safe haven. Those who crossed the ocean wished to have the freedom to be true to themselves. For now, they were simply called the Portugals. They had brought dried codfish with them, and cheese made with thistle powder to set it, rather than jelly from the hooves of animals, the rind covered by paprika to prevent rot. Maria learned their language, for she had an ear for such things, and made certain to help those women brought low by seasickness with a spoonful of ginger paste and a slice of orange, carefully doled out to the ailing women and their children. For even the smallest taste of fresh fruit was a tonic. She listened to their stories and observed them when they lit a candle on Friday at sunset, for candles were dangerous at sea, just as religion was dangerous on land. At night, Maria wrapped herself in her cloak and watched the stars appear in the sky, one by one at first, then whorls of constellations pricking through the darkness in a brilliant ceiling of light. How immense and beautiful the world was, especially to a girl who had never even been to town while growing up, never seen a shop or a market or a church filled with people as the bells rang on Sundays. She wished that Hannah could stand beside her on the deck of the ship and feel the future as she did, as a place where a woman might command her own fate. She was grateful that she had been found in that field of snow and raised by a woman who was truly kind, just as she was grateful that her mother had given her the gift of sight. What was before her was still a mystery, even when she looked into the black mirror, for she had changed her fate when she came to cross the sea, although some aspects of the future remained the same. The daughter she would have, the man who brought her diamonds, the snow in the branches of the trees. When she saw bits and pieces of the time to come, she knew she would find the sort of freedom her mother and Hannah hadn't known. There had always been women who commanded the same talents as Maria, and most had taken refuge from the world, so they would not be tested by drowning. If a witch floated, she was proclaiming her pact with Satan. If she drowned, she was innocent, for all the good it would do her to be dragged lifeless and bound from the depths of a river or pond, often wearing iron shoes nailed to the soles of her feet. Maria's predecessors would have thought her mad to be so far out at sea, with nothing but the waves around her. But she was convinced she had nothing to fear from water, only from men who saw evil where there was none. On windy days, when it seemed the ship might take to the sky and the sailors tied themselves to the deck with ropes so they wouldn't rise up into the whirling air, Maria kept Caden safe inside her cloak and fed him bits of cracker. A ship was a terrible place to be as the weeks went by, with less food and water and all manner of pestilence, lice and rats, lightning and storms. There were times when those on board thought the end was near. Men who had never prayed before did so, many in a language none of the sailors could decipher. Women blessed their children and held them tightly so they might walk into the nets of death side by side. But Maria could see enough of the future to know they would reach their destination. She looked in her black mirror and saw that the sun would be stronger than any of the passengers would have thought possible, and the streets would be made of red dirt, and the trees would flower in every season. "Hush," she told the Portugal's children when they cried. "We've almost reached the other side of the world." When they arrived, it was exactly as she had seen it would be, a land of oddities and miracles. The passengers looked out and blinked in wonder at where their journey had taken them. The cactus towered 30 feet tall. Thorny acacia bushes bloomed with vivid lemon-colored flowers, and the divvy-divvy trees were bent over in the wind so they might look up to heaven. The children said these trees were little men wearing overcoats. There were yellow and orange birds in the sky, troupials and bananaquits, along with kingbirds and flamingos and hummingbirds no larger than bees that passed by a person's ear and left that individual's head ringing with a soft buzzing sound. There were birds that only flew at night, nighthawks and nightjars, black shadows in the dark and the dusk that drank dew from leaves as big as saucers. People of all sorts could be found here due to the Spanish slave trade and the settlement of Sephardic Jews. Many had on modest traditional clothing, long skirts called sayas, worn over pants and shirts with combinations of two or three patterns. A young woman named Uni, only a year or so older than Maria herself, was waiting on the dock sent to hurry her along. Uni clapped her hands and called out a welcome in Dutch, in disbelief when she realized that Maria knew little of that language. "You had better learn to speak as we do," Uni advised, in English now. "Or maybe you have the right idea. This way you don't have to listen to what Mr. Janssen says." The captain handed Maria her papers, which stated that she belonged to the Janssen family of Willemstad. She was to work for them until the age of 16, at which time Maria would be a free woman. She now understood that her father had sold her into servitude. He would likely say it had been for her own protection, and perhaps he meant no harm. She was a girl on her own, after all, with nothing to her name. "Are you free?" Maria asked Uni as they walked side by side on the dock, crowded with fish vendors and sailors, some of whom had no allegiance to any country and sailed only for themselves, pirates and traders of the roughest sort. "I'm the same as you, not a slave and not free. That's another way of saying we're nothing." Uni's skin was a warm brown, and her black hair was as long as Maria's. Her African mother had been bound to the Janssen's household as a slave, and her great-aunt had been granted her freedom only after working for the family for 30 years. Uni herself was a servant, and had been so all her life, since the time she was born, with no papers that affixed a time to her servitude. To Maria, that sounded like slavery. "You have no papers?" Maria asked. "No date for your freedom?" Uni was extremely beautiful, and men of all sorts stared at her as they walked along. Mr. Janssen holds on to them for me. I'll be free when I marry. But in fact, each time a suitor came around, Mr. Janssen found fault with him and sent him on his way. It didn't matter if a man was African or Jewish or Dutch. None would do. Niet goed genoeg, he would say every time. Not good enough. I plan to never marry, Maria announced. She had seen a daughter in her future, but no husband. Only the man with the diamonds, who, as they walked along the wooden dock under clouds of parrots, seemed an impossible fate. That's what you say now, Uni responded. Just you wait. If you're married, you won't be a servant. I'm not certain I can be that now, Maria said, a scowl on her face. We do as they tell us until they go to bed. Then we do as we please. Maria had never had a friend, and had never seen the need for one, but now in this faraway place she was grateful that Uni had a kind heart and had taken her under her wing. Do what I do, say what I say, and you will be fine, Uni assured her. It was easy to see how enchantments might be brought about here. The sky wasn't blue in the early evenings, but instead there was a palette of color that ran from rose to deep violet to cobalt to ink. There were 68 varieties of butterflies on the island, including large orange and black monarchs and tiger wings that only flew in the shade. The air was moving and alive, and when the wind came up suddenly, it was a soft, dark breeze filled with salt and the tang of seaweed. Trapped in his carrying case, Caden called to be set free. Not right now, Maria told him. You'll be out soon enough. Mrs. Janssen wouldn't like a bird here. She'll say it's filthy and will ruin her house, Uni warned. Not that Maria cared. Mrs. Janssen doesn't need to know. Uni smiled at her then. The new girl seemed more interesting than most, and she thought she would be pleased to see how the household was provoked by someone who didn't seem concerned with their rules. As soon as Maria was rid of her grimy clothes that she had worn day in and day out, and had washed with strong soap and water so hot it stung, she began her new life. She was only a girl and exhausted from her journey, but she would do as she must in order to survive. There were two other servants sharing their chamber, sisters from Manchester, England, who had only another year to work off their debt. We'll be gone in the blink of an eye, the sisters boasted simultaneously, for they had the habit of saying the same thing at the same time. They thought they were better than Uni because her mother had been a slave, and better than Maria, who was so young and inexperienced. Maria waited for the other girls to go to supper, then she hid her grimoire beneath the floorboards before going off to explore. She knew well enough to keep her bloodline a secret, for her talents could bring her luck or misery. It was a curious place she found herself in, the opposite of all she had known. Where there had been darkness, there was now light. Where there had been a solitary life, there was now a bustling household. Much of the living space was outside, and as she crossed the courtyard, she marveled at how in this arid subtropical land there could be a garden that was so lush. She walked along a path that was bordered by mangoes and Jamaican apple trees, and brilliant flowering aloe vera speckled with yellow blooms. It was here she set Caden free. She had crafted an amulet to wear around her throat with a single black feather, so she knew he would always be called back to her, no matter how far he might go. The bird studied her from the branch of a guava tree, then rose into the dusky air of this new world of theirs. By now it was evening. The moon itself seemed different here, glowing with pale silver light. In the salt flats there were miraculous birds, flamingos, white and scarlet ibis, green herons, great blue herons, and the black-crowned night heron that cried in the dark as if it were a woman pleading for her life. But of all these, it was the robber crow that was most beautiful to Maria, for he had more compassion than any man she had ever met, and far more loyalty. At supper, Maria was served funchi, a soft cornmeal dish, along with a small bowl of stoba, a spicy stew flavored with papaya, left over from the Janssen family's dinner. It was a large household, the Janssens and their three daughters, all nearly grown and looking for husbands. Uni and the sisters explained there was more than enough work for them all. They were pleased that Maria had come to stay. As for Maria, she was polite and cheerful, for Hannah had always said there was no need to ever let anyone know what you were thinking. Why be punished for your thoughts or beliefs? Maria believed no one should have her life signed over to another, but she kept quiet, knowing that in the end, she would do as she pleased. To amuse the other girls, she told fortunes by examining the lines on their hands. She had informed them that for women, the right hand was the fate they were born with, but the marks on the left hand told the story of what they had experienced, the choices that had changed their original fates. The heart line was always most interesting. It was the mark that showed who was selfish, who would be content, and whose heart would be easily broken. She told them all they would fall in love and marry, which was true enough, leaving out the details they wouldn't wish to hear. Who would fall in love too easily, and who would find sorrow, and who would make a choice she would later regret. The Manchester girls were pleased with Maria's special talent and called her their little sister. Little sisters would do well to be cunning, and it was wise for Maria to get along with everyone, at least for as long as it suited her, and it would have to suit her until she was free. She had one last precious orange left from those her mother had given her, and this she shared with the other housemaids before they fell into their white metal beds, the girls so happy to have her among them that no one complained when she left the window open on warm evenings to make certain that Caden could always come home.